Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 20 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He's spent time as an analyst in both Florida and Texas, and Mark Stallo credits him with the initial development of the IACA website. In fact, he is in my top 10 most influential for the IACA. He's an analyst, developer, and manager. Please welcome Jim Mallard. Jim, how are we doing?
Doing great, Jason. How are you doing?
I am doing well. It was so great to see you and meet up with you in Las Vegas at the conference a couple of weeks ago. Wasn't sure when we would meet up next, but that was definitely a great surprise.
It was indeed. I've missed the last few conferences for one reason or another. So it was great to kind of get back in touch and reconnect with old friends and see what everybody's up to and get re-immersed in the IACA conference experience and all that. So it's definitely great.
Well, let's go in the Wayback Machine then. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, I won't start at the very beginning, but I can tell you that I was in Gainesville, which is where I grew up, Gainesville, Florida. And I was in grad school at the University of Florida, and I was in the archaeology program. My undergrad's in anthropology, and I was focusing on Florida archaeology at the time. And I needed some extra money, so my ex-wife, then wife, told me about this internship in the IT department at the police department. And I was pretty good with computers. And so she kind of nudged me, hey, go get this internship, go apply, blah, blah, blah. So I went, I ended up getting the internship there. So I started at the Gainesville Police Department in 2001. I actually started right after September 11th. My start was delayed because of September 11th and the background stuff. So I think I started in early October or mid-October of 2001. I was working as an intern, a paid intern in the IT department. And primarily what I was doing, they had an old RMS with AS400. And they had no way of getting information out of it. It was just a black hole. And I had been using Dreamweaver and doing some basic web development. I knew how to connect to databases and build queries and extract information and create web pages. So that's what I was doing. My very first task for them was to basically create a mechanism for the detectives to do very, very basic things like search the cases that they were assigned, search an offender's name, just basic stuff. And I had fun because it was clearly something that was beneficial for them. So I did a lot of that. And then I built a couple of applications for new things that they didn't have yet. And then I also worked on hardware. We had very limited budget. So I convinced the IT director to just go out and buy a bunch of machines, like bare bones machines. So he bought a bunch of cases and motherboards, memory and hard drives. And I built about 50 machines for the department and imaged them and put them out so that people had better computers to use. So I did, it was just IT stuff. But through that, I got to get a taste of the police culture and certainly the police data. And at the same time, I was kind of getting disillusioned in archaeology. I know there's sort of a romantic aspect to it, but the reality is, for me at least, the reality is that field archaeology is a lot of hard work. It's basically manual labor, a long time in the field, very, very poor conditions. And then you spend years in the lab. And then after you do all that, you end up with more questions than you have answers for. You're only ever getting a very tiny sliver of the puzzle. And I found that to be very, very annoying for two reasons. One, I really wanted gratification of answering a question. I didn't like the fact that the chair of my department, you know, after spending years on a project would say, well, this is what I think, but I have all these other questions. And that was really annoying to me. But the other thing was I grew up on a farm. I grew up doing manual labor all my life. And I didn't foresee myself doing that for the rest of my life. I was trying to get out of that, not get into it. So while I was an intern, this analyst position opened up. My internship was expiring about the same time. So I applied for it. I kind of knew what the crime analyst did. There were two other analysts there at the time. I kind of knew what they did because I had already been working with them a little bit. I knew who they were. So, but I understood the data and I had good technical skill. So I applied. There were three finalists. I got the position. That's how I started as a crime analyst. From there, I worked at GPD for about 5 years. And then my wife at the time, my ex-wife, really wanted to relocate. She wanted to get out of Gainesville. She was from New York. She wanted a bigger city. She liked Dallas. There was an opening for a supervisor position in Arlington. which is in the DFW area. So I applied for that, got that position, moved out there for 5 or 6 years, and then wife became ex-wife. So that gave me an opportunity to go back home to Florida. So I went back to Florida to start a crime analysis program at the Winter Park Police Department, which is a really small city just north of Orlando. Loved it. Wonderful department, very small department. Had a great time there. But in the process, I got remarried, and my current wife, my wife's family's in Houston. So, and we had twins, so we relocated to Houston. So I was hired at Houston PD as an intelligence analyst, but the goal at Houston was to basically develop an enterprise crime analysis program, which they don't currently have. And so they created a director position, a crime analysis division manager position to oversee that. And so I applied for that and got that position as well. And that all came together last year. So I'm currently the crime analysis division manager for the Houston Police Department.
It's so funny doing this show because I'm always amazed by what I learned, because we've known each other for at least 15 years, it seems. Mm-hmm. And I would have never guessed that you were an anthropology major.
Yeah.
And so it's fascinating. Did you always have the technical skills or the technical, the desire to learn?
Yeah. You know what? I've thought about this. I cannot tell you with honesty where I learned the technical stuff. I rack my brain to kind of think about like where I started picking it up. And the only thing I can remember, it really is just in college, like when I was working on my master's in archaeology, I was basically cataloging and collecting specimens in the museum. So I was using Excel. So I wanted to learn Excel, but then I heard about this thing called Access, that it was going to be a better way to store that data. So then I taught myself Access so that I could create a database of the ceramics that I was cataloging. And so, I mean, it kind of came about that way. And the hardware stuff, honestly, necessity is the mother of invention. And I was a broke college student and I wanted a better machine. So I read about and learned how to build a computer because I could do it cheaper. The components were cheap at the time, but the labor and buying a computer was expensive, but I could build one for half the price. So I taught myself how to build computers so that I could save money for myself, really is what it boiled down to.
Man. And so you're basically self-taught.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so when you start at Gainesville, do you feel that you're an analyst or do you feel like you're another member of the IT department?
At Gainesville, no. Once I became an analyst, I felt like I was an analyst because I was only doing analyst work. Now, there is one exception to that. This is kind of a funny aside. Before I applied for the analyst position, the IT department was hiring a new programmer analyst, and I felt like I was a great fit for that. So I went and got my A+ certification because that was one of the prerequisites. That was the only prerequisite for the position I didn't meet. I actually applied for the programmer analyst position and fully expected to stay in IT and get that position, and that would be the end of the story. I didn't get it. My network admin, for whatever reason, chose somebody else who I've become good friends with and been friends with him for years now. But when I became an analyst, he kept coming to me, asking me how to do stuff. And he did that the entire time I was in Gainesville. And then when I moved to Arlington, he moved to another police department in South Florida, and he kept calling me, asking me how to do stuff. And then when I moved back to Orlando, I helped him get a job at Osceola County, which is just basically down by the attractions. So it ended up, he got the job that I had applied for, and I had spent years helping him in different agencies. So he made me feel like an IT guy while I was an analyst, just because he kept asking me how you do this and how you do that. And different things like that. But other than that, I felt like I was an analyst. I mean, I was working with ArcGIS. You see, I know it sounds like coming from archaeology into crime analysis is this foreign thing, but it actually was an incredibly smooth transition. They both have very similar sociological backgrounds. I was using ArcV3 in archaeology because that's what we were using to map the site data when we were shooting points and doing transit data for three-dimensional mapping of archaeological sites. We were using ArcView. So I already knew the software. I just didn't realize they used it in other fields. So when I learned that they were using it in crime analysis, I was like, oh, okay, well, cool. I didn't know the software. You know, to me, it was an archaeological software, not something else, you know. So it wasn't that hard of a transition. But once I became an analyst, I was really focused on, you know, investigative support, tactical crime analysis, and ArcGIS and all that sort of stuff, and really never looked back.
So this leads us to your badge story, your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, this is the career-defining case or project that an analyst worked on. So for you, it's at this time in Gainesville, 2006, you're dealing with a serial flasher.
Right. So I had been an analyst for a few years. And so we started, for context, Gainesville is a college town. It's kind of, it's an isolated city. It's not adjacent to anything else. There's a lot of green space all the way around. So it's kind of an island, if you will, geographically. And it's a college town. 75% of the population are students. And so it is the quintessential college town. So we have a lot of indecent exposure type cases, sex type cases, that is just a part of being in a college town, I suppose. But in 2006, in the summer, we started getting these reports of a serial flasher. And basically, he was hiding along a jogging path, and then he'd jump out and expose himself. It was a report here, it was a report there, but it started to become a pattern, and we knew something was going on. And when we talked to the victims, one of the victims was, she was preparing for a marathon. And so she was out jogging. These were occurring at like 5 or 6 in the morning. So she was out every morning, very early, out jogging. And he had been exposing himself to her, particularly multiple times. And so we talked to her about kind of what was going on. We never really had good suspect information. We didn't have good clothing description, no vehicle information. It was just like, hey, this guy keeps doing this over and over again, and I'm really getting annoyed by it. She would get a friend to go jogging with her. That didn't deter him. So we were getting more and more cases. We had like 6 cases a month, and that was a lot. And then we started getting cases in a different part of town. One of the victims there said, you know, I used to jog in this other part of town, which happened to be the same part where the marathon runner was practicing. She said, I used to jog over there, and this guy was exposing over there. So I came to this other part of town, and now he's following me over here and he's exposing. And we were sort of like, okay, maybe it's somebody different or whatever. We didn't have enough information to put them together. The two areas weren't that close. Then we started getting cases in a third area, which wasn't close to those two areas. And it was one of those things where the activity itself was unusual, but there wasn't a lot to connect the three. So anyway, we started working on it, and they had done a detail and nothing really happened. They put some undercover officers out in some different places, but it never materialized. So when we started getting these additional cases, we noticed that it started to escalate. So he went from just jumping out on the path and exposing himself to jumping out and grabbing their buttocks or grabbing their breasts. So he was escalating his behavior. And obviously that was a big concern for us. So I took a look at all the cases. I looked at the geography. One of the areas was very large where all the incidents were occurring. The other two areas were relatively small, but I looked at where the cases were happening. I looked at the times. I took whatever information we had, which wasn't a lot, but I pieced together 3 areas that were pretty small within a couple blocks that I felt like were the main hunting grounds. Now, in the third area that I mentioned, there was one victim in particular that he was targeting, and she was out in that area. It was a residential area. She was out there every morning, and he was targeting her. He wasn't just offending in that area. We knew something that he didn't know, which was that she was about to go on an international vacation for a few weeks. So we knew that she wouldn't be available as a target coming up. So I took the other two areas, narrowed them down to these kind of small areas. We had a pretty tight time frame, and that's pretty much all we had. A shorter, dark-skinned male was our suspect description. So we came up with a plan, and the plan was to put decoy officers who matched the victim description, which was college-age females with long hair, in those two target areas. So of the two, I prioritized one over the other, but it wasn't much of a prioritization. So I had pretty tight geography, had a pretty tight time frame. Those were the two key things that we had. Beyond that, we didn't have a whole lot. So we went out, we did a new detail. On the first day of that detail, there was a vehicle that followed one of the officers in the first area that I had identified. He got spooked, so he never engaged the decoy. He drove around, kind of followed her, and then, the other detail was that it was a loud vehicle. So that's why we thought that was our suspect, because the vehicle, the muffler was broken or something. So that's why we suspected that was our suspect, because he kind of followed her slowly. But then for whatever reason, he got spooked and he left. The very next day, the second day of the detail, the car showed up again in the second area that I identified. So when he parked and got out, we had tons of officers like hiding in the woods, and you know, we had people all around. So he parked and he got out, and he was just about to jump out, and boom, he got swarmed. So we took him down there and got him identified, got him arrested. And so it was really good because I had identified these two kind of tight areas and he hit both of them on the first days of the detail. It was just perfect the way it came together. But really interesting thing, I think, is what happened afterwards. So we talked to him. He ended up being a 30-year-old Hispanic male who lived in another city about 30 miles away. He was a landscaper. And so he was coming into town early in the morning to do landscaping, but he was doing this activity prior to starting his job. So he wasn't from the area. He had no criminal history. He had a wife and kid at home, but he was coming into town to do work. And as part of that routine activity, he was flashing and he thought it was fun. He got a thrill out of it, obviously. At the time we arrested him, we only had 15, 16 reports, something like that, over the span of a few months. But when we talked to him, he confessed to over 200 incidents over the last couple years. So when we went back and looked, I did find a few other cases that based on the information he gave us, we could probably match to him. The thing is, you've worked in decent exposures, I'm sure. Just the nature of it, we don't usually get good suspect information. The victims are usually, you know, shocked by this guy throwing his junk out there. So we don't get good suspect information. We don't get a lot of information to separate one indecent exposure from another. And in a college town, you already have a fair number of them. It's just hard to say these are related, these aren't. But once we talked to him and he gave us specific locations and dates and, you know, general dates and times, we could kind of put some more cases together. So it turns out he had done this, you know, a couple hundred times over the course of a couple of years. We had less than 20 cases. So the interesting thing is that I was able to identify his hunting grounds. We were able to catch him on 10% of the data. That is very important because we, you know, as crime analysts, I know that we struggle with this. We don't want people to be victimized, but we need more data. And this case taught me that you can do it with less data. And granted, there were aspects of this that were very consistent, right? His time of day was very consistent. That was related to his job. That helped a lot. His MO was consistent, although escalating. So those elements helped, but we just didn't have a lot of information. The other thing I learned was you have to listen to the victims. You have to listen to them. I know there's a tendency in law enforcement for people to just, you know, throw up the BS flag. Well, that sounds preposterous. That couldn't be, right? When our victim came to us and said, look, this guy has targeted me in two different parts of town, we were skeptical, but It was true. And believing her helped us link those two areas together. So listen to the victims. The other thing that I learned is when you don't know what's important, everything's important. So, you know, in this case, was it geography? Was it time? Was it victimology? And the answer is yes, it was all of those. So you have to keep a really open mind about things when you don't have all the information and you don't know what's important. Focus on what you have and work with what you have.
I'm curious to know, was there any hesitation by management to throw that much resources at this particular issue?
No, that was one of the good things, believe it or not. Remember, they had already done this type of detail before, but they didn't have any concept of where. And I mean, they knew the time frame, but they didn't put officers in the right place at the right times. So when I was able to narrow it down, I was able to articulate why I chose these areas. And it had to do with the particular victims that he was targeting, the specific times and those specific locations. The first area, which is actually the area we arrested him in, that whole circuit, it was basically like a big apartment complex area, but it was 11 square miles. So there, the jogging path was the outside of that 11 square mile area. It was a very long series of roads, I guess, to that jogging route. And he was hitting all along there, but there was one area that he was concentrating in. And when you look at it, you could kind of understand why, because it's a place where you could park near the path. There was plenty of wooded area. It was easy for him to conceal himself. So I was able to articulate to them why these three areas were his hunting grounds and specifically why these two areas were the target. We were able to narrow it down to a point where we could put a lot of resources in it, but we didn't have to do it for long, right? Mm-hmm. Our morning detail was only 2 hours and we only needed a couple decoys. We needed more covert officers, but we didn't, this wasn't a thing where we had to do it for 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. We had a really tight geographic area and a tight time frame to work with. So I think they were more amenable to it because of that. And because we knew that the other victim wasn't going to be there, we knew we could discount that area.
So did he actually follow the one victim from one park to the other, or how was he picking his different parks?
Okay. He did. And I think that he kind of stumbled on that second area because of her. because he had followed her. And when he saw that she was jogging in that area, then he kind of moved over there. I think maybe he felt like he had burned the first area a little bit. So he was trying out a new area. It was kind of a more of a residential area. There were apartments, but there were also houses mixed in too. But I think he was interested in her. She attracted him to that new hunting ground. And then he kind of stuck around in that new hunting ground for a while as well.
Well, very good. Let's move on now to you becoming a manager. And I just wanted to get your perspective on transitioning from an analyst to a manager.
Yeah. So I first did that in 2007 when I moved from Gainesville to Arlington to become a supervisor. So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem, right? You can't become a supervisor unless you've had supervisor experience, but you can't get that unless you've been a supervisor. So this is it's kind of a tough step. For me, going into that position, I didn't have any supervisory experience aside from having an intern that I supervised. We were cleaning up our GIS data in Gainesville and improving our geocoding rate, and our planning department wasn't doing it. So we at the police department did that. So we took the center line, and I had this intern working for almost 2 years to improve the quality of the center line. So, and I managed him, supervised him, but I didn't have any hiring and firing responsibility. It was mainly just more of like a team leader for that particular intern more than anything else. But that's really all the supervisor experience I had. So Arlington took a chance on me because I didn't have supervisor experience, but they felt like because I had a good technical background and they needed that. And I had some experience with CompStat because we were doing CompStat in Gainesville. I guess, you know, they felt that kind of outweigh the supervisory part. It's sort of like with me as a manager now, when I look at applicants, I value critical thinking above technical skill because I can teach you technical skill, but I can't teach you critical thinking as much. It's much more difficult. So I think they looked at it and said, well, he's got the technical skill. We can mold him into a supervisor. And to their credit, the city had a supervisory program already established for supervisors throughout the city and in various departments, a pretty good program where you go in and, you know, once a week for 6 months and sit and go through a lot of good material. It was very, very, very helpful for me. So it took a while. I had a lot of growing pains. The hardest part about becoming a supervisor is that you're not doing the work anymore. You're now dealing with people and people's stuff and people's issues and who doesn't get along with whom and who didn't show up to work on time. And it's administrative personnel issues and evaluations and performance and it's not crime analysis. So that was a hard thing to get used to. And I'm a believer that you shouldn't be as a supervisor. And I mean, you have to maybe in some situations, but I think supervisors should not be working supervisors. You have a job. You shouldn't be doing crime analysis because you have to focus on bigger things. So what I did in Arlington, my big project was to revamp the CompStat program there and to make it automated and to make it more robust. Well, I can't do that if I'm in the weeds working on crime analysis projects as well. So that the transition for me was that I didn't have supervisor experience, but that I learned that sort of on the job. My apologies to my employees. But, you know, we got through it and I still talk to several of them to this day. Actually, most of them, they probably like me more because I'm not the supervisor anymore, but, you know, but we got through it. So that's the big transition. And for me now at Houston, not a big transition at all, because I already have now that experience from Arlington. So it was really not a big deal. The difference here now is I'm a manager, not a supervisor. So I'm at a higher level. So I have bigger projects to work on in Houston and a much bigger agency. I'm very fortunate that I've had the opportunity to work at Gainesville was about 375, 380 sworn. Arlington was about 12 or 1300 sworn. When I went to Winter Park, it's only 85 sworn. So a very small department. And Houston has over 5,000 sworn. So I've worked at each different size agency. So I see how things go on. And I've been able to parlay that experience into my current role as a manager in Houston.
I find it fascinating, the idea of delegation, because delegation is actually a skill, I feel.
It is. It absolutely is.
Because there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. Mm-hmm. And to be able to task somebody a job without getting it too far into the details, being able to box it in so they can take it and run with it is not always an easy thing.
Jason, you hit the nail on the head. Mm-hmm. Delegation was the single most difficult thing I had to learn as a supervisor. Being okay with somebody else's work, being okay with them taking the lead and getting something done. It was a very difficult thing to do. When you're in the job as a doer, like as an analyst, and then you're a supervisor, you still have that doer mentality, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to do everything. And there's a certain amount of, you know, for lack of a better word, there's a lack of trust, I suppose, mm-hmm. that I don't know if you can get this done the way I want it done. So I'm just going to do it myself. That's just the easy way to do it. Very, very difficult skill to learn. And I feel like I've got it down pretty well now. So I delegate now and I don't have a problem doing it.
Do you have any tips for delegation?
You know, like you said, it's a skill that you have to learn. You mm-hmm. have to teach yourself to be okay with the way that somebody else interprets a project. Now, it's your responsibility to make sure that they have the skills and the resources to do it, but you need to be okay with it. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's little things like, well, you used Calibri 12 point font, but I really wish you would have used Tahoma 11. You know, it's, you've got to drop that stuff. You've got to be okay with it. And the way you do it is sort of the way you described it. You set up the constraints, you set up the expectations and what the deliverable is, and you just don't get in the minutiae. You have to remind yourself, unless the thing they did differently or the thing that you perceive is wrong, unless that thing is critical, drop it. I mean, if there's some methodological issue, address it. But if they used a color that you're not as crazy about, but that has no impact in the project, don't worry about it. If they used a different way to get to the answer than you would have used, but the answer is still correct, drop it. Don't push things unless there's a reason. You can articulate a reason. For example, just going back to color, right? Let's say somebody used a color that you don't like. Well, if the reason you don't like it is because you know that your projector washes out colors and that color is going to look terrible on the screen and you can show them, yeah, make it an issue. But if it's just that you just don't like it and there's no objective reason, then drop it. You have to teach yourself that, and it's a very difficult thing to do. I'm lucky that I have good people that I can entrust to get things done. You know, very recently I was out of the office and my chief called me and needed a chief level project done right this second. And I'm like, I'm not their chief, but I tell you what, I'll put you in touch with an analyst that I know that I trust to go do the job. And I called him, he went, met with them, got what they needed, got it knocked out. And I had complete faith in him to do that. They loved what they got. And so it all worked out. And I wasn't killing myself to rush back to the office to take care of the chief's request because I didn't trust anybody else. So you have to have faith in your employees and help develop them to the point where you can delegate and trust that they're going to do it right. And you also need to have their back when they do it and it's good and right. And somebody else, for whatever reason, if they have the same objection, well, that's not how I would have done it. You need to have their back and support them in that.
Good. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I still want to stay with Houston there because the department is going through a civilianization process with their analysts. So I want to get into that. I want to get your advice. And of course, I want to talk a little bit about IACA. You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
What's going on, analysts? My name is Manny San Pedro. I'm the technology director for the IACA. And here is my public service announcement for analysts. Don't become overly reliant on Excel. Use it to analyze and break down your data. It's a fantastic tool. Fantastic. And it's free as part of the Microsoft Office offering. But don't use it as a database. Use a database as a database. Connect to the database with Excel. And then use it for your pivoting, for all your slicing and dicing, even developing your dashboard. But again, don't use Excel for everything because it may not be the best tool for you.
Hey, this is Sean Bear, and I would like to suggest that everybody go learn programming. I think that's the one thing that has carried me through all the different aspects of my life. And if you learn some programming, you'll better understand the application that you use, and who knows, you might even be able to write your own application. Good luck.
Happy anniversary, IALEA, International Association of Law Enforcement Intelligence Analysts, turns 40 this year. LEA Podcast is proud to produce a series of panel podcasts dedicated to the IALEA anniversary. We are going over training, chapters, and certification. We'll talk about the past and we'll talk about the future. So join us on Wednesdays as we celebrate 40 years of IALEA. Welcome back. Jim, let's talk about the civilianization of the analyst positions at Houston PD. I know you're not quite there yet, but it's a fascinating topic to me, and I want to get a little bit of the background as how you got from the beginning to where you are now.
Sure. So Houston PD is a very large, very old agency. And right now there are a little over 100 analysts or people performing the analyst function, I'll say, throughout the department. The bulk of them, probably 75% of those analysts, are officers or senior police officers. That's just how they did it. And I know it's sort of like in a lot of places where even with civilians, right? It's a smaller agency. You need a civilian analyst. You can't get the city to fund a new position. So you take an officer position and you reclassify it as a civilian position. You get your analyst and then you go to city council or whatever and you beg for another officer. Mm-hmm. A lot of cities do that sort of tactic. So I can't tell you why the specific reasons why the majority are officers. I suspect it's just because they have police officers and that's what they use them for. They use officers for everything. Houston's very segmented. There's lots of specialty units and lots of different things for officers to do. And I think that it was just an evolution. Hey, we need people to be analysts. And they look out at the officers and they say, who knows how to use a computer? Oh, you do? Okay. You're going to be an analyst now.
You can type.
Right. You can type. You're an analyst. So the way it is in our divisions at the patrol level, the majority are officers. In fact, all of them are officers except for one. There is one civilian, and that's a very recent thing by a fairly progressive commander who is kind of helping my cause a little bit by creating a civilian analyst position in one of the divisions. And then the investigative units, homicide, robbery, major assaults, those units, they are civilians primarily. My commander has a vision for crime analysis. He understood, well, my former commander, he recently was reassigned, but had a vision for crime analysis. He had been to the ICA conference a few times. He didn't know anything about crime analysis when he took over the division, but after he took it over and he started learning more about GIS and crime analysis, he realized that we are way, way, way behind. We're behind in terms of the staffing. We're behind in terms of technical ability. We're behind in terms of the way we're structured. He realized that crime analysis is a profession that is outside of law enforcement. He met private sector analysts, and it's outside of HPD. It's outside of law enforcement. There's analysts everywhere. And he understood that it's a profession outside of HPD. In HPD, it's an assignment, right? If you're a patrol officer, you're assigned as a crime analyst. But outside of HPD, it's a profession. So his goal was to professionalize HPD by civilianizing the analyst staff. And so he had two main projects when he took over the division. One was to create the GIS unit, which he did. So now we have a very robust GIS unit with a great GIS manager and some really progressive applications that they're developing. And then the second part of that was to hire a division manager in crime analysis and begin the process of civilianizing the department. And so we've had lots of high-level discussions with the chiefs about this process. The process itself is not unfamiliar to HPD. They went through it a few years back with dispatch. There was a time in the very recent history, there was a time when our entire dispatch was sworn. The dispatchers, the supervisors, everyone in the operations center was sworn, and they civilianized it. And the sun came up the next day and everything, you know, it was perfectly fine. And so they did the same thing with the forensic unit, the crime scene unit. They civilianized that. And once again, the sun came up. So there's tacit approval at command staff and executive staff level to do it. So what I'm working on right now is the enterprise plan that sort of serves as the framework for how that looks at HPD. What does it look like? And what I'm building is a program that basically has a tiered analyst structure, analyst one, analyst two, analyst three, analyst supervisor, and then division manager. The goal is that people can come in as an entry-level crime analyst. They can work in any part of the city because everybody's civilian. They have a lot more mobility. They can eventually, through testing and tenure, rise through the ranks and get promoted to an analyst two, an analyst three, perhaps even an analyst supervisor, and eventually possibly the analyst manager. I'm not going to be there forever. So what I'm trying to do is create a professional track that is a career path that helps promote retention, but also serves as a long-term cost-effective means to deliver a higher level of service. right? Because now, and you know that our world is different. When I started as an analyst, you know, almost 20 years ago, analysts were staff assistants. They were IT people. They were whatever you could get to do the job. But now there are people who go through school to be a crime analyst, and they come out with certificates in crime analysis. And there's tons of universities that have online programs to be a crime analyst. And now, now it's an educational track. And it wasn't that way when we started. So there are actually people that I can recruit to come in who understand the job before they start. And that's fantastic. But I can deliver a higher level of service because everyone knows what they need and what they want, but we just have difficulty delivering that. And there's so many issues, I think, having officers do this job, not only cost, but just, you know, they're subject to transfer, they're subject to promotion. Our officers get pulled away to do crazy stuff all the time. You know, we have one division, I met with them. And they were like, yeah, well, I want to get this map done, but I have to go out and move the traffic cones for this special event. You know, so when you have that sort of those competing interests, you don't have the best person in the role. And also training is a big part of it, and standardizing it. We don't have standardized products throughout the city. So your mileage may vary depending on where you're assigned. Commanders have different expectations, but part of that's driven by a lack of knowledge about what analysts should be doing and what they can do and what their best use is. So there's a lot of benefits to it. It's going to take some time. We're at the very beginning stages of this. It's going to take time. It may take up to 10 years to get the whole team transferred over. It's kind of a budget issue. I figure it's probably about $10 million to do the whole thing, but mayor's not going to give me a $10 million check. So we're probably going to do a handful of positions at a time and then do a supervisor position, then do more, you know, just do that until we get most of them done. What they did with the dispatches, they did about half of them. And then at a certain point, they just went ahead and did the rest. I don't really want to hire 50 analysts at once, like NYPD hired 100 a few years ago. I don't want to hire 50 at once because I don't think there are 50 high caliber people all looking for a job in Houston at the same time. So I don't mind hiring 3, 4, 5, 6 at a time, but I'd prefer not to do a whole big bunch at a time.
To your point about sworn and transferring, it's worth their while as they want to get promoted in the police department to be well-rounded. So to spend time, a couple years here and there to get experience at all various departments is beneficial to them when they go apply to be executives.
Sure.
Whereas you're talking about an analyst, you know, that's a very specialized profession that you're staying in. So it's just a different mindset, a different goal altogether.
Right. And I argue that it's sort of like dispatch and being a highly specialized position, as in crime scene processing is highly specialized as well. And don't get me wrong, we have some officers that are super, super talented because they have computer science degrees or they have
You know,
tech background. So we definitely have officers that do a great job. One of our officers who's in gang is just absolutely fantastic. So it's not to say that the officers, you know, can't do the job. It's just that there's competing interest in different things. And for those who want to promote and get out, it doesn't promote a strategic vision of crime analysis. What I'm looking to build is long-term stability. And the reason, for example, so I'm a commander equivalent on paper. We have this sort of civilian equivalency thing. Mm-hmm. By having a civilian manager in place, it helps promote that strategic vision, because when you have a sworn commander, they get transferred. You get somebody else in, maybe they have a different vision. They tick things in the opposite direction. But if you have the civilian structure in there, you can kind of insulate against some of that and have a more strategic focus, have a 5-year plan, have a 10-year plan, build some of those things out that you might not be able to do when you have all sworn in management positions.
So what are some of the cost savings? Obviously, the pay with insurance and all the benefits packages of an officer versus a civilian analyst. I mean, the officer's going to be more. What are you seeing in terms of the differences between the two?
Well, the cost savings is a long-term cost savings. It's not short-term. So because in the short term, we're not getting rid of officer positions. We're creating new civilian positions. So there's an initial investment for the civilian. Now, this with the civilians, you have the salary plus benefits. We estimate 30% on top of salary for benefits. That's how we do our budgeting. For the officers, so our officers have tons of contractually obligated incentives and bonuses. And I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but an officer, I think our officers start out around 55, 60,000, but most of them make much, much more than that because you get shift differential pay. You get bilingual pay. You get night shift pay. You get hazard pay. You get clothing allowance. You get mentor pay. You get FTO pay. You get all that stuff. Plus we have to buy you a car. We've got to buy your, you know, all this equipment to support your job. Mm-hmm. For, you know, for an analyst, you're talking about $2,000 for a machine and some software licenses. And that's pretty much the extent of the equipment, the vast majority of it. We're not breaking the budget with pencils or anything. So there's a big equipment budget too. So there's an initial investment. So our analysts start around 57, but you add 30% onto that and that's your number. And that's mm-hmm. still probably per head, 20,000 less than what the officers make. So there is a long-term cost savings person to person, but the initial investment is expensive because you've got the upfront cost of funding the position.
So what's the argument to those that are pushing back?
Well, there hasn't been a ton of pushback, but there is one kind of unique argument that they make that it has merit and it's something that we have to mitigate. Houston has this weird property tax cap where it's something they passed probably 10 years ago that basically there's a set amount of money that Houston can get from property taxes, regardless of what the tax rate is and regardless of how much money is actually brought in. There's a cap. It's not adjusted. It's a cap. So if property values suddenly soared and there was excess money, that goes to the county. It doesn't go to the city. So there is a hard number that we have to stay under. Every year, it's in the books. There's nothing we can do about it. So when things like the housing crisis in 2008 happened and other types of things that have giant budgetary impacts, there are layoffs and furloughs and things like that. So the biggest argument against having civilianized staff is the concern that when these budgetary challenges occur, that those civilian positions are going to be lost. And it has not happened at the pay grade level for analysts, but there have been some analysts who have left the department for fear that it would happen because of the perceived lack of stability. I'm not sure what we can do to mitigate that. We do have classifications like whether or not a position is considered critical or non-critical, but there's some politics around that. And sure, some position can be considered critical or not critical depending on other factors. So it's not a hard and fast definition. I can't go to the mayor and say, look, fund this program. And by the way, make it mandatory that these positions won't get cut. So I can't guarantee that it won't happen. I can only provide strong assurances that it won't. And my hope is that when the division commanders see the value that they're being provided by those employees, when it comes time to make budgetary decisions, that they're going to make those decisions in other areas. I would like to think that long-term, as we save the department costs, that we won't encounter those budgetary problems, but that's just not realistic. Where that money will get sucked up somewhere else in the budget and it won't be an issue going forward. So, And we also had an issue a couple of years ago with our fire department. They hadn't been, there's a lot of politics around it. Basically what they did is they got a proposition on the ballot to get raises and other things. They got the public to vote on it. Everybody loves firefighters. They voted on it, but it would have created $100 million plus shortfall that caused the mayor to institute hiring freezes and all sorts of things. And it was a giant political battle, very ugly. It was eventually ruled unconstitutional because in Texas, only the bargaining unit can negotiate salary. You can't go to the citizens and get it done as a ballot initiative outside of that process. It was ruled unconstitutional, but they still renegotiated a contract, gave them some extra money, but the hiring freeze is still in place. So right now I have two senior positions that were just approved last week actually to fill. So now I just need to get them created in the system and pretty soon I'm going to put those postings out, but I have to go to the mayor every time for every position and get approval to fill that position. I have one other analyst position in the pipeline that I need to fill, and it's that paperwork is working its way through the bureaucracy, but I have to go to the mayor every single time. So that hiring freeze is still in effect, but he has the discretion, or he can exercise the discretion to fill positions as needed. I just have to convince him that they're needed.
We'll be interested to see how it all turns out.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So
it's a tall order. I mean, I'm optimistic that it can be done, but there are a great deal of, you know, it's it's as much changing the culture as it is anything else. So now one thing I will tell you, just as sort of an aside, I haven't had pushback from the union, and that's mainly because we're not getting rid of officers. But I know other places that have talked about civilianizing have run into issues with the police union because you're taking cops away to create civilian positions. That is not an issue for us, but that is a real issue that other areas may encounter. And that's definitely, you have to tread lightly with the politics and be very familiar with what's going on in order to address that successfully. Because if you don't, and you're not aware of the politics around that, you may not be successful in getting it done.
Yeah, it's not a surprise that the union would be concerned. So, all right, well, let's move on to the IACA. You certainly have been an influential member over the years. So let's just talk about how you first got started with the IACA.
Sure. So I was an analyst in 2002. And so when I started, the other two analysts had been to the prior conference, the 2002 conference in Orlando. They loved it. So we were, all three of us were able to convince the agency to send us to the 2003 conference, which was in Kansas City. But when they did that, they made it clear that that was the only conference that they were going to pay for us, and that we weren't going anymore, and that that was it. But I had been hearing so much about this awesome conference that I was like, man, I got to find a way to keep going. So there was a bulletin contest. So in 2003, at that Kansas City conference, I submitted an entry in the bulletin contest. And at the time, the grand prize for the bulletin contest was all expenses paid for the next year's conference.
Nice.
Well, I won the bulletin contest. So that brought me to the 2004 conference. I went to the 2003 conference. It was an awesome conference. I won the bulletin contest. That allowed me to go to the 2004 conference. When I went to the 2004 conference, I met with Sean Baer, who was doing the IACA website at the time. He obviously had his own company, Baer Software, was developing some really good tools for crime analysis, but on the side, sort of as a pro bono thing, he was taking care of the IACA website. So I talked to him at the 2004 conference about it and said, hey, Sean, look, I kind of know web stuff. I'm happy to do it. And he was happy to give it to me. You know, it was one less thing that he needed to worry about. And I had some ideas about what I could do with it based on my prior work with databases and, you know, building dynamic websites. So he gave me the keys and said, here, run with it. So I started work in rebuilding the website. And so I did. And so I, from that point, for the next 10 years, was the technology director. That title didn't come about until a few years later. It was just, I was the website admin. I mean, I just kind of did it. So over that 10-year period, I rebuilt the IAC website three different times. I built it to the specs of the way the organization ran. So what I was most interested in was allowing the board and the committees to manage their jobs in a more efficient way. And so it was a pretty robust site. I have to say it did the things it needed to do. And we were able to really move forward and streamline a lot of different processes and streamline the different committees. You know, training and conference are the two big ones. So there were a lot of cool tools in there to do that. There was the ability for members to track their progress through certification, which was when I first started the website, we didn't have certification, but I eventually built that in so they could go in and upload their documents and kind of track their progress. And they knew when they were ready to sit for the exam and all sorts of other, you know, a lot of membership stuff and just managing members and allowing members to search for other members and just, you know, just typical web stuff. So in 2015, I had been very reluctant to be on the board. I didn't want to be on the board. I just wanted to be in the shadows, lurking, you know, like a crime analyst, right? I want to be involved in the case, but I don't want to be too involved. I want to be in the shadows. I had been asked to run for a board position for a while, but I was just reluctant to. So, but there were some things going on with the IACA and some challenges. And I felt like 2015 was a good time to transition from just doing technology to being on the board. And so I became the vice president of administration in 2015. And then in 2016, I became the president with the resignation of Noah Fritz, and was the president from 2016 through the end of 2018. I didn't run again. I have twin daughters, and they were born in August of 2018. So in December of 2018, the last thing I wanted to do was re-up my three-year obligation to run the IACA. So, you know, one term was enough, not even a full term as president, but two years as president was sufficient. And it was a good stopping point for me. During my tenure as president, we really focused on branding and marketing the association and professionalizing it. We developed the new logo that you see today. We initiated the new website, although the current board finished the new website and got it launched. We built a new trade show booth. We did new graphic and assets for the conference. We were just trying to update the look and the branding and get the name out there and professionalize the IACA. That was kind of our focus for that time period that I was on the board. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of it. I spent a lot of time with the IACA, but I feel like I did my time. I did my tenure. Now that I have the girls, they're three now, that's kind of my full-time job. I don't have a lot of time. It used to be, you know, in the mid-2000s, I could spend 10 hours on a weekend coding the website. Mm-hmm. I can't even watch 15 minutes of TV, you know, unless it's Little Einsteins or Mickey and Minnie Mouse or whatever. So, yeah. So I just have different priorities now, and I just don't have the kind of time to devote to it that I used to have. And there's so many other talented people in the association. Like right now, Manny San Pedro is doing a great job. There's many talented people, giving them an opportunity to step up and show what they can do and helping them to contribute is perfectly fine with me. So I was happy to turn over the keys in 2018 and let other people take the reins.
Yeah. Well, you could always get your daughters to start coding.
yes, I could. They're pretty smart.
Yeah. So I do find it fascinating that you did transition from, you know, I know when we talked in the prep show yesterday, you said, well, I'm more than just a technical guy, but you were the webmaster for IACA for so long. When I think of the website, I still think of Jim Mallard. But the transition from that technical position, the volunteer, the assigned position, to then getting into more of the politics of the being on the executive board and going through voting, you know, it's complex, because not only are you making that leap, it's a total different way of going when you're actually running a campaign, but you're also doing it during a time, it's 2015. It's, you know, I've talked about this several times on this podcast, is just, you know, you want to call it dark times, you want to call it civil war, whatever you want to call it, that's also going on at 2015 as you're making this transition from Jim the webmaster to Jim the vice president of admin. Well, a year later, you become president, and then your daughters are born. Well, actually, wasn't there, there was a like a hurricane, right? You missed one conference because of the hurricane, and then the very next year, you missed the conference because your daughters were born. So the two years that you were president, you actually missed the conference. So it's just a really odd set of circumstances that you're actually on the board.
Yeah, you're right. I actually never had the opportunity to do a presidential address at a conference, because in 2017, I'm in Florida, and the week of the conference, we had a hurricane roll in. And I mean, it was down to the wire. Like, I think I can go. And they shut down all the airports. And in Orlando, I can fly out of Jacksonville or Orlando or Tampa. They're all three international airports. Everything was closed. Everything closed down. And I couldn't fly out. I couldn't even if I wanted to. And I really wanted to, but I just couldn't. So, and I believe that hurricane actually did come into New Orleans where the conference was. And I think that there was some, you know, there's some bad weather, but it wasn't, they didn't have to shut down the conference or anything, but everyone was kind of on edge. So yeah, I had that. And then my girls were born in August, 2018, and I could have gone to the conference technically, but I'm pretty sure my wife wouldn't speak to me if I left her with 3 week old infants to go away for a week to a conference, you know.
They were your second ex-wife.
Yeah, she would be my second ex-wife, right? So I didn't feel it was appropriate to do that to her, and I'm really glad I didn't, actually. So yeah, I didn't get the opportunity to do those presidential things at the conference, and I do, you know, it's a regret, but it's just the way it happened. But again, it's just, you know, everybody has sort of a different path to get to it and get out of it. I made the decision to step up in at that time, the what you call the dark times or the Civil War, because those things were going on, and because I felt that the things that were going on weren't right, and I felt like I could make a contribution there to kind of improve that. And there were other things that I felt like the vision for the ICA kind of got lost because there were a lot of things going on, and I wanted to help refocus that a little bit. And I think we had some impact. Obviously, we didn't get everything done that we wanted to get done or needed to get done or should have gotten done. But I think we got a lot done in a very short period of time, and we had a great board. You know, Annie Mitchell still chugging away on it on the board. She was our board member then. She's the only current board member that was on that board. So we got through that time. time, and I think the association's better now, and in many ways continues to improve. So I'm happy with my tenure. I think we got things done, but I'm not interested in being a lifelong ISCA board member. You know, I mean, honestly, I spent probably close to 15 years donating time to the association to do what I could to make it better. And I feel like it's grown enough that there's enough people who have an interest in volunteering and helping and have the talents that there's, I don't feel like I did or am leaving the ICA in a lurch because I'm no longer active on the board or active in the technology committee.
So what were some things that you didn't get to that you wish you did?
Well, the bylaws was one. And I know that there was recently the vote on a lot of bylaw changes. Mm-hmm. We tried repeatedly to get it off the ground. We just couldn't get a consensus and couldn't get the momentum behind it to get the bylaws to get revisions down that we were happy with. That's probably the biggest thing. Reforming the ethics process to prevent some of the things that happened from happening, mm-hmm. Was another thing that we didn't deal with. And I feel like to this day, it's still a vulnerability for the association. So those were the two big things. And they were big because those were kind of the issues of the time. And we did do a lot to address them, but we just didn't make any progress with them for a variety of reasons. And also with the board, you know, you have different people. Although everyone on the board knew each other, we all worked well together, we had fundamentally different philosophies about how to address things. Even though the way it was structured, that the president is the CEO, it's still collaborative. And you mm-hmm. can't just do things unilaterally. So if you don't have consensus on issues, you don't get issues resolved. And that was one of the things that we struggled with. We did get the third edition of the book finished too. I forgot to mention that. That did come out. Mm-hmm. That was a big one. That was a big project that had lingered for a while, wasn't getting done. For new members or young members who are in the association, they may not understand that it's a volunteer organization. So people are volunteering their time. And some of these, we're trying to do really big things on volunteer time. And so when you're creating a book and you're trying to get the authors to finish their chapters and you're trying to get the book edited, you do what you can, but you're not paying people to do this work. So you don't have a lot of leeway in getting it done. You're relying on people's good graces and their volunteer time to accomplish these large projects.
It's interesting. I'll mention the book because I actually... it's still running the contest for the podcast. I have an Easter egg in my chapter on Excel that I told if anybody gets the Easter egg, I'll just send them a $20 Amazon gift card. So I don't know. I don't know if the Amazon gift card $20 is it worthwhile. No one has gotten the right answer thus far in terms of
challenge accepted.
The Easter egg that I put in my chapter.
I did not know there was one in there, but I will go find it.
Yes. So, but yeah, that, very good. That was certainly something that it did take a while. I remember I had my chapter written and completed whatever the original deadline was. Mm-hmm. And then there was stuff that I left off because I was like, well, I needed to meet the deadline. It was the first and only time that I ever wrote a chapter for a book. Mm-hmm. And then like a year later went by and I went back to the publication committee and I said, well, should I rewrite this or should I add this stuff? They're like, no, yours is done. We're not changing it. don't change it. And then, right. I think it was even like a couple of years after that it finally did get published. So it was like, geez, I could have really beefed that up in the time that it took from when I entered mine to when it was actually published.
Yeah. And I wish they would have done it, but I completely understand why they didn't. It was just a struggle. You know, we had a cadre of very talented authors who were creating these chapters and just getting them done and edited it's a very tall task. And you're trying to do it to a very high degree of quality, the highest you can do. So in your case, you know, because it was done and you had submitted it, they didn't want to touch it. And in retrospect, you probably could have updated it and it wouldn't have been a big deal, but you know, they had already edited it. They'd have to re-edit it. And yeah.
I understood. So. But yeah. Interesting. All right. Well, let's finish up with some advice for our listeners. And, you know, I always like to think ahead and return on investment. So what is something that an analyst can study now that in 5 years from now, they'll get a good return on investment?
Well, honestly, I think that analysts need to be, in general, technology, just be aware of technology. And that's things like cryptocurrency, prevalence of misinformation, and the challenges that it presents to analysts. And this is an old concept, but technology facilitates it, makes it a lot easier to do things. It's no longer an issue of lack of information. Now it's too much information and trying to sort out what's real from what's fake. It's getting more and more difficult to tell the difference. You know, it's easy to create a fake persona. Criminals always have new ways of avoiding detection. I don't know if you're familiar with deep fakes, but the AI technology is evolving where you can make videos with somebody saying words that aren't theirs. There's websites like thispersondoesnotexist.com where you go and just keep refreshing the page and it's showing you all these images of people that don't exist. It's AI technology to develop extremely realistic human faces, social engineering. So just as a quick aside, I stumbled on this accidentally on a stock site and it kind of shocked me. So I was looking at some stocks recently. Actually, I was looking at a YouTube site and this guy was flipping through the stock page and he was showing some numbers for a stock that didn't seem realistic because I had looked at them the day before and it just didn't look right. So I went and it occurred to me that you can, I probably should have known this already, but you can pull up Chrome, for example, open up a web page, go in and inspect the page and type into the HTML and the website itself reflects the edits that you've made. So what I thought was that he had basically done that and then left the page up. And then in his video, all he did was scroll the page. He never refreshed it. Mm-hmm. So, and it was done so seamlessly. He's presenting this seemingly legitimate analysis of a stock based on fraudulent information that he himself created. But because it's on the official website, it looks like the real thing and you're none the wiser. So it's just one of those ways that it's just typing. Anybody can type. These AI sites are accessible to everybody. These tools are out there for criminals to use to create fake profiles, to create all sorts of fake things. So I think in general, like Mark Twain said, what gets us into trouble, it's not what we don't know. It's what we know for sure that just ain't so. And I think that's like a guiding principle with this. I think analysts need to be at least aware of the technology that's out there that allows people to, and be aware of the ways that those technologies can be misused to either misrepresent themselves or conceal what they're doing. It's not like this stuff is inaccessible. Even basic coding stuff, there's enough code out there where somebody who really wants to manipulate a website or hack something, they can go find it. It's there. Yeah. And so I think analysts really need to keep an eye. They don't have to know the nuts and bolts and get really down deep into it, but they just need to be aware of what technologies exist, how they might be misused, and how that might affect their ability to do their job and how it might affect their investigations. And not just social media. I'm talking about things sort of outside of specific social media platforms.
Evaluating the truth of the data. Interestingly enough, you mentioned the website. For my coworkers, the 1 year on their birthday, I took whatever I thought their favorite web page was or what they were interested in. And I did what you were talking about. I took the code and then I put like ESPN.com. One of the guys was a sports guy. So I took ESPN.com, what it was that day. And I changed the headline to be happy birthday. I was able to do that several times and I just saved out the code out on the network drive.
Yep.
And then anybody that had access to the network drive would get it and it would look just like a web page to them.
Yeah, I could go to a lottery site and change the numbers to whatever numbers you picked yesterday and convince you that you won the lottery. I mean, these are so accessible in a way that it just wasn't accessible in the recent history, right? It used to be where you had to know Photoshop and be able to go in and make these really good edits and make it convincing. You don't have to do any of that anymore.
All right. Well, very good. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And this is where you can promote any idea that you wish. Jim, what are your words to the world?
Well, I think probably the idea that there are not smart people or dumb people. It's just that everybody knows different things. And when you learn to recognize what people do know, I think you'll appreciate people more than by focusing on the things that they don't know. And it's kind of a hard lesson, and it's something that you have to continually remind yourself, but we have a tendency to categorize people in this dichotomy of whether or not we perceive them as smart. But I think what we're really saying when we categorize people like that is that we're making an assessment of whether or not they know the same things we do. And we're ignoring the fact that they may have this whole world of knowledge that we know nothing about that is still valuable. And we're discounting that because they don't know the thing that we know. So I would encourage people to not label people as being smart or dumb, but really focus on learning what things people do know and focusing on that and not focusing so much on the fact that they don't know something that you know. That doesn't make you smarter than them.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with you giving me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Perfect. I'm going to go find your Easter egg, by the way.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Jim. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.